This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive.
Every Tuesday at midnight after the news, only on listener-supported, non-commercial WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City. Be there. right. Opening up with some of the irresistible Persian Sufi pop of Niaz. I thought that was not on continuous play, but apparently it was. Sorry for the artifact. Deliciously imperfect WBAI 99.5 FM here in New York City. This is the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade. I'm Bill Weinberg. Once again, that was the music of Niaz. And we are joined live from via telephone from California, once again, by Frida Afari of the website Iranian Progressives in Translation, and Kamram Afari, the author of Performance and Activism, Grassroots Discourse After the Los Angeles Rebellion of 1992. But Kamran is going to be speaking with us about the more recent rebellion in his home country of Iran, and also by Kevin B. Anderson, co-author of Foucault and the Iranian Revolution. Are you guys all there?
Yes.
Hello. Hello. Nice to be here.
Nice to have you. So there's been a resurgence in recent days of particularly student protest in Iran following the historic waves of protest that we witnessed earlier this year after the contested elections of June. And, in fact, I see something on Frida's website about a student by the name of Majid Tavakoli, who has become something of a symbol for the Iranian student movement. Maybe, Frida, we could start off by saying something about him.
Majid was originally involved in a protest in December 2006, which actually took place the day after Ahmadinejad's conference, which denied the Holocaust. And it was a major event in that students at Abin Kabir Polytechnic University tore up his pictures and called him a source of prejudice and hatred. And then a few months later, he was arrested. The government claimed that he had issued a publication which insulted Islam, which, of course, the publication itself was fraudulent. But then he was put in jail. He was severely tortured, released about a year and a half later, and then was arrested again at another protest and released again several months later, once again tortured. And this time he was still brave enough to attend the protest on December 7th, which is the anniversary of a student protest that originally took place in 1953. After the Prime Minister Mossadegh was overthrown in a U.S. CIA-backed coup. And what was interesting and really important about his action was that, first of all, you know, he had been in jail twice. He still nevertheless went out. The demonstration itself was important as Amir Kabir, but it didn't just take place there. There were demonstrations around the country in various cities, not only in Tehran, but in other major cities of Iran, Shiraz, Tabriz, Isfahan, Kermanshah. Even though the number of demonstrators necessarily in each location wasn't massive, the breadth was very impressive. After he gave a speech at Amir Kabir University, his own university, on this anniversary, he was arrested as he was exiting the building and violently arrested and beaten, taken into custody. And then soon afterward, the government published the photo of him dressed in a women's hijab or a women's chador, ridiculing him for attempting to flee dressed in women's clothing, making fun of him for being a coward. And this set off a set of responses by student activists and bloggers defending him, defending the student movement, and saying the government's action, in fact, shows two things. One is that they're the ones who are the cowards because they're really afraid of how the student movement is growing. And secondly, some of the women activists pointed this out, that here for years the government of Iran has been saying that the hijab is a sign of honor for women. And now that they've put a man in women's clothing or women's hijab, they're saying it's a sign of humiliation. So some of the feminist students were saying this really shows that the compulsory hijab is a sign of humiliation. Of course, they don't mean hijab if it's a voluntary action. They respect the right of a woman to wear the hijab if she wants to. But they think that the compulsory hijab is a sign of humiliation for women.
Okay, now they have been making this argument out loud and overtly.
On the internet, in their blogs, and there's also a very important site published by students at Amir Kabir University. And they had been publishing a series of responses, one after another, during the days after Majid Tawakkali was arrested.
Yeah, there are hundreds of photographs on this website of Iranian men wearing chadors. If you just Google Iranian men headscarves, you'll get it.
Okay, now.
With all these photographs.
Huh.
That was another response. Some of the men.
A week or two.
Exactly. Some of the men went ahead and took pictures of themselves wearing the chador to say that there was nothing humiliating about a man wearing a hijab.
As a gesture of solidarity with Majid Tawakkali.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
And also,
including Hamid Dabashi, who is a professor at New York. I'm sure you
Columbia
know.
Columbia University.
Kevin, you were going to say something?
Oh, no, I guess saying that Dabashi is a professor at Columbia.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And I think there was something about solidarity with women and women having to wear the chador in those photographs, too. I mean, it's just kind of... And as the gay writer Doug Ireland pointed out, because that's where I first saw it in a post that he had forwarded from an Iranian activist, and Doug pointed out that... it's illegal. Cross-dressing, along with a whole bunch of other things, is illegal in Iran. So anyone getting their photograph taken is violating the law, but the problem is the chador is a disguise also, so it's going to be pretty hard to be sure who these guys are.
Mm-hmm. So, so this professor at Columbia University has been making the case very overtly, but to what extent are people within Iran... openly expressing solidarity with Majid and openly dissenting from the mandatory chador and this sort of thing?
As far as I know, most of these photographs are from within Iran.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
They've just been posted.
Really? And so people are showing their faces, because the chador does not actually cover the face. So people are showing their faces on the internet in a very overt sign of dissent from the regime.
I mean, Frida might have a better idea on that, but that was my impression, was that a lot that most of these people are in from inside Iran.
And the articles that I was referring to were all written by students inside Iran.
Mm-hmm.
There are many bloggers who are publishing statements saying, we're all Majid, we defend Majid. I mean, they remember him from 2006 when he originally got arrested. I'm sorry, 2007. The protest was
December. I think at the time, you on your own website, we had, and there was a solidarity statement at that time about these Iranian student protests, because these were actually led by Marxist students. This was in December 07, as Frida was saying before.
December 06.
But
actually, Majid is a member of an organization called Office for the Consolidation of Unity, which is an organization of liberal students, which is really the largest student organization in Iran.
Okay, but weren't, I'm referring to December 07. Wasn't that when the Marxist students were protesting?
Yes.
So the reason I mention that is that this date, when the latest mass demonstrations in Saudi Iran taken place, is a date that's particularly identified with the left. It doesn't mean the demonstrations last week were leftist in character as such, but it is a date that has much more resonance with the left than it does with the religious people.
All right, and dating back to a march in...
December 7th, 1953, about 6 months after Mossadegh was overthrown.
In a CIA-backed coup.
Yeah, you're talking about a time in this. The CIA just helped overthrow Mossadegh. The Shah's come back to power. They've arrested everybody. that they could think of that would lead any kind of opposition. So it's a tremendously brave act on the part of the students at that time to have demonstrated, just as it is today. And so it's in that tradition, in part, that this is happening.
Mm-hmm. And I understand that Majid was previously arrested in some labor solidarity stuff in support of striking workers. Have I got that right?
I am not aware of that, but of course he did support labor struggles as well.
Mm-hmm. All right, so there's been this, to the extent that the media is still paying attention, there's been a lot of focus on the fact that recently this week, the students either did or didn't, depending on who you believe, burn pictures of Ayatollah Khomeini. And there's been some talk, but this was actually carried out by agents provocateurs from the regime. But there's also some talk that this symbolizes a real radicalization of the movement and rejecting the notion of an Islamic Republic altogether. So what's your take on this development, any of you?
Kamran, would you like to
hang on that? Maybe I'll say something brief on that. This is the burning of the tearing up of Khomeini's photo was something that was shown on national media, the government media in Iran, over and over immediately after December 7th. So the first response to that came from Karoubi, one of the candidates who claimed who was also in the elections, presidential elections, and who said that this was a insult to the movement, first of all, because he, as one of the leaders of the movement, and Mousavi and others consider themselves followers of Khomeini, and that they consider this a form of fraudulent, a continuation of the same fraud, basically, that the national media is using this photo. It's not clear whether it was staged, whether it was any of their followers. They're using this to basically organize their own supporters to have them go out against the movement and a way to split the Green Movement. Khatami, the former president, came out against it, and Rafsan Ghani came out against it. Quite a few people came out and started immediately having to defend themselves. Now, there's the history of the government using these type of images, setting up these images to attack people, dating back to early 1990s during Khatami's reform era. In Germany, for example, they used clips from a videotape to attack and arrest reformist...
A videotape that was taken in Germany.
In Germany.
A videotape that was taken in Germany of what?
That was shown at events where something had happened. Some maybe nude dancing was taking place, or some.
There was a conference in Germany, and then
nude dancing had taken place. Did I hear that right?
Yeah, there was a conference of Iranians in Germany. I mean, both from inside and outside Iran, and then some people got naked.
Mm.
The photographs of this went back to Iran, and the people from Iran really got into difficulty because they were present at this event.
Mm. All right,
A lot of what people are saying in response to it in the Green Movement are saying two things. One is that a lot of them do not consider themselves followers of Khomeini, and that so they're not going to, you know, fall into the trap of having to toe the line of becoming followers of Khomeini. At the same time, they're saying, look, a lot of the leaders of the Green Movement have a political capital of using, you know, their association with Khomeini as a way of legitimizing themselves, and we're not going to let the government take that away. So they're basically, within the Green Movement, there's some discussion about how to respond to this attack from the government by, you know, trying to color the entire movement as being opposed to Khomeini and therefore, you know, illegitimate. And so this is one way that they're trying to respond.
Okay, we need to define terms a little bit. For starters, what do you mean by the Green Movement?
Okay, very good. The Green Movement, of course, came out of the electoral struggles in the aftermath of the June election, basically. Each candidate had to select a color, and Mousavi's campaign ended up selecting the color green, and so supporters of Mousavi were using the color green in their posters, in their flyers, in their the way that they were organizing for the electoral campaign. So after the campaign, after the cheating, and after there was this protest movement on the streets, a lot of people adopted that color as the color of their movement. And so there's, it's a large umbrella movement that includes Muslims as well as secularists who are fighting against the fraudulent elections, the results of that elections in June.
Well, green is also the color of Islam.
That's true.
Yeah, this was their luck in getting that color. Well,
so what color did Ahmadinejad choose, just out of curiosity?
I remember.
I don't think he chose. It was actually a lottery.
Okay. So it really was just luck of the draw that Moussaoui got the color, which is sort of associated with the revolution.
That's correct. And with Islam more generally.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, I think I would add just one thing on the green movement, which is that over the summer and since, it's become a much broader movement against political repression and for transformation of the system to some degree. I mean, at least toward some kind of more democratic system. I mean, that's, in other words, I would just say that these, the terrible repression, including rapes in prison and so forth, of both men and women on a fairly large scale, has really galvanized much broader sectors of the public behind this movement.
Well, the protests are not at the same level, certainly not numerically now, that they were back in, you know, when hundreds of thousands were coming out to the streets in, over the summer.
Let's look very briefly at what has been happening since this summer.
Please.
September 18th was a Quds Day or Jerusalem Day, which is a traditional day of protests in Iran in support of the Palestinian movement. What happened was the crowds were the celebration with pro-regime slogans was to a great extent taken over on the street. Some reports said up to 500,000 protesters on the streets of Tehran. That's September 18th. November 4th was...
Okay, now when you say protesters, you mean explicitly in opposition?
Wearing green, chanting opposition slogans, that kind of thing.
All right, chanting opposition slogans, because, I mean, once again, there could be some ambiguity to wearing green, given that it's the color of Islam.
Sure. Well, yeah, but they... There's certain ways of wearing it and so on that I think are distinctive.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, then November 4th, the same thing happened. This November 4th is the traditional day that commemorating the taking of the hostages and the takeover of the U.S. Embassy.
Yes.
November 4th, 1979. So that's a big day of kind of commemoration of the regime commemorating itself and its origin. Again, the crowds were, to a large extent, anti-regime protesters, and they were. And some new slogans came along by this time, and I think maybe at the earlier demonstration too, but definitely by this time, we're saying Iranian Republic as opposed to Islamic Republic of Iran, and some of these kinds of slogans, which, in other words, that's much more than, you know, changing the results of an election.
Right. Well, another thing we've heard, that in addition to tearing up the poster of Khomeini in the recent protest this week, students also waved a Iranian flag from which the symbol of Allah had been removed, which was, of course, added to the flag after the 79 right. revolution.
Right. Yeah, there were several things going on like that. The thing of burning, it was actually burning a portrait of Khomeini. That was what was shown on TV. That, I'm convinced, I was very suspicious when I first saw it, and I think the New York Times really blew it the next day when they had a story talking about how this was a sign of radicalization of the movement, because, as Kamran was saying, there's a whole history in Iran of staging these kinds of things, going back actually to the Shah's time.
All right, so you mean agents provocateurs.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. There was a time when, you know, remember the World Peace Council of the 1950s and some of those... kind of anti-nuclear movements that were heavily communist in some of their organization. They Shia, there were younger mullahs that were associated with that, and one of them went to a conference abroad, to one of these world peace congresses, and when he came back, and he came back to the religious city of Qom, there was a demonstration stage where people were, like, you know, burning Qurans and chanting things against, I don't know if burning Qurans, but they were chanting slogans against religion and for atheism.
Hmm.
So this, there's a long history of this kind of staging these kinds of things in Iran. Therefore, the Iranian public is much more sophisticated about reading through those kind of things than other publics might be.
Okay, so is what we just witnessed this week the most significant upsurge since the day in November when they commemorated the hostage taking?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, and some are saying it was the biggest one since June.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
And as far as Brett is concerned, it included the most number of cities.
Yeah, it spread to regions of the country where there weren't that many, hadn't been touched by the June and summer protests.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so what I'm trying to get at here is, are you in fact reading the protest that we saw this week as a sort of a real significant break with the notion of an Islamic Republic, or are you viewing that as kind of the regime's provocateur propaganda strategy?
I think that...
Or is it ambiguous?
Based on reading articles on the internet by women, students, other bloggers, I would say that there is a very, very strong, very, very strong support for the idea of separation of religion and state among the protesters. Does not mean that they reject Islam, but they certainly reject the way Islam has been used by the current government to oppress them. To the extent that many of them don't want to be associated with the burning of the pictures of Khomeini, it's not because they love Khomeini, simply because they think that is going to hurt them at this point. But I would say that the notion of separation of religion and state has many, many supporters in Iran right now, especially among the youth and women.
Mm-hmm. I hate to have to bring up a purely technical matter, but one of the three of you is on a phone which is giving us a lot of static. I don't know if you hear it as well, but if there's anything you can do to try to keep that under control, whether it's not moving around or whatnot, that would be good, because we've got some sound quality issues, unfortunately. All right, keeping that in mind, again, on the terminology question and sort of defining the argument, the debate, there's sort of been this juxtaposition of liberal versus more radical Marxist tendencies within the movement. Well, for starters, the word liberal is, you know, the definition of it sort of varies from country to country. So in the Iranian context, here we go again. We've got some serious static issues happening here. I hope we can try to keep this under control. In the Iranian context, what does liberal mean?
Go ahead, Kamar.
I'll just say one word, and that was immediately after the elections, the very first acceptance speech by Ahmadinejad, the victory speech by Ahmadinejad, he called for the end of liberalism in Iran. He said this was the proof that liberalism is a bankrupt ideology, and that they have what he's proposing is, you know, a different alternative that has been vindicated. And of course, you know, a lot of people, as a result of that, immediately started, a lot of people who would not consider themselves liberal started actually saying, no, we do consider ourselves liberal. And in some ways, you know, they're talking about the rule of law, which they say that the current government is not adhering to, that they're not observing even their own constitution, that even, the separation of powers within Iran, the fact that the role of the supreme leader is not to be in, you know, such a total control executive position, but someone that interprets rules as opposed to the kind of interventionism that the current leader has been engaged in. So a lot of people, in that sense, I think the word liberal has had a resurgence in the last, especially in response to Ahmadinejad, as it's not a dirty word in Iran anymore.
All right, so liberal just in the sense of pluralism, the rule of law, human rights, etc.
Yes, and also among the students and intellectuals, there's been a strong interest in liberalism in the sense of the philosophical concept of rationalism as opposed to voluntarism or arbitrariness. That's why there's been so much interest, for instance, in Kant in Iran or Habermas, because after having lived under a regime which arbitrarily assigns meanings to certain ideas and makes decisions without any type of rational explanation, the idea of rationality seems very attractive to a lot of young people. And that also explains the interest in philosophy that's been very strong in Iran over the past 10, 15 years.
And you also have a, you could call it liberal Islam, or, I mean, it calls itself Islamic reformism. But this is the people like people around Mousavi, the people around the Khatami regime, Khatami presidency, which is in power from 1997 to 2005. Those kind of groups have absorbed a lot of Western philosophical thought on the kinds of thought that Frida and Karman were just referring to. But do these people want to maintain an Islamic republic of some sort? But a more open form of Islamic republic? Whereas the people that would call themselves liberals would be, among the students and so forth, would be more secular. And there are socialists among the students as well. And
right, which is what I want to get to
there's
next.
There's also people who share the postmodernist critique of liberalism. I mean,
all
the philosophies that we have here are over there. Volume 1 of Capital was translated and circulated widely. Volume 2 of Capital is being translated. These kinds of things are happening.
Well, I'm sort of surprised that didn't happen a long, long time ago. I mean, certainly...
Well, they were translated earlier. It's a newer, better translation.
I mean, I would imagine even if it's been fairly suppressed under both the Khomeinis and, the Ayatollahs, and the Shah, I would imagine that certainly back in the 50s and so on, Marxists must have translated all three volumes of Capital into Farsi.
Frida, were all three translated before, or just volume one?
As far as I know, volume one was translated by a member of the Tudeh Party, which was the Iranian Communist Party that backed Stalin. And it wasn't until 2 years ago that we had a new translation that was done by an independent Marxist.
All right. I should point out that it is now 12:34 in the morning on Listener Supported at Non-Commercial WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City. My name is Bill Weinberg. This is the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade, and we are speaking with Frida Afari of the website Iranian Progressives in Translation, journalist Kamran Afari, who is the author of Performance and Activism, Grassroots Discourse After the Los Angeles Rebellion of 1992, and Kevin B. Anderson, author of Foucault and the Iranian Revolution and other works. And we are speaking about the struggle in Iran. And all right, so maybe we should talk more about the more radical currents which exist within the movement. I mean, you've mentioned Marxists and socialists and postmodernists. Well, why don't we talk a little bit about each of those tendencies and to what extent they exist within the movement and what their critique is?
Well, I want to say something about something that I posted on the Iranian Progressives in Translation just a few days ago, which is a dialogue between two different Iranian socialists that was published in an Iran-based website called Al-Burz, because I think it shows some of the differences and would be of interest to American listeners. The dialogue was about whether socialists should be supporting the Green Movement. And one person was arguing that this movement is being led by liberals, using liberals in a pejorative sense. Do you still hear the echo?
A little bit, but I think it's the best we can do.
Okay.
The echo is actually not as annoying as the static, which I don't hear at the moment.
Okay.
So please keep going.
Okay. So he was attacking the liberals for supporting the policies of the World Bank and wanting to get rid of subsidies, which is actually something that the Iranian government plans to do in a few months. They're planning to phase out all the subsidies on basic food items and gas. And he was saying, how can we even think about supporting such leaders, opposition leaders such as Mousavi and Karoubi, when their only goal is to privatize the Iranian industry and not assist the working class? And then another socialist, in response, had written an article published on the same website, argued that, well, first of all, you have to understand that the Green Movement is quite diverse and just doesn't only consist of their point of view. And secondly, it's very abstract to speak. The author of the previous article ended his article by arguing that we need a socialist revolution and we need to not even rely on any of these leaders of the Green Movement, but simply call for a socialist economy. And so in response, the young person had replied was saying, well, you have to be very concrete about what this movement consists of, that it is a movement that is mainly led by the middle class, but has very, very strong support among working people and the poor. And so you can't just dismiss it as a middle class movement. And secondly, if you're going to speak about a socialist alternative, you have to be very specific. You can't just talk about socialism as an abstraction. You have to relate it to the forces that exist in the current movement, the young people, the women, the unemployed. And what he had ended with, which I thought was quite interesting, was that it's not enough just to say we defend the poor and the working class. We have to look at how the Iranian government has been using, has been attracting certain sectors of the poor to join the military and to join the militarization of the economy. And they're now using a certain ideological test to hire more members of what's called the Basij or the militia to work for them. And the author of this article claimed that that will actually alienate the Iranian working class, because they're seeing that, first of all, there's growing unemployment, and secondly, that the jobs are going to the members of the Basij or the militia or the Revolutionary Guard, and so they feel left out. Whereas in the past, Ahmadinejad claimed that he was for the poor and he was giving them subsidies and helping them. In fact, Ahmadinejad is giving jobs only to the members of the Basij and militarizing the economy. And he thought that this really was the new development that the left should be looking at, instead of only speaking in abstraction about the socialism. And I thought that was quite a fascinating debate and really revealed some of the differences that exist among socialists inside Iran today.
Well, we should point out that even if Mousavi has not dissented from the whole program of imposing austerity and privatizing industry and so on, I mean, Ahmadinejad also embraces these same policies, correct?
Correct.
Yeah. So, and yet, there is this persistent notion that there is this class content to the struggle in Iran, and that the working class is behind Ahmadinejad and the bourgeoisie is behind the protesters.
Which is not true at all. And in fact, I can give you so many examples of worker protests that have been taking place in the past year. I think last time we spoke with you, I mentioned some. But even since the last interview, I think two of the very important events were, well, first that there was the protest of the workers of Haftapeh Sugar Company in the south, in Khuzestan. They had been protesting the non-payment of wages and the lack of union rights. And four of them have just been put in jail. Whereas up until now they were trying to avoid actually being imprisoned, they were finally put in jail.
On what charge?
On the charge of sedition.
Mm-hmm. And in addition, some labor leaders have been sentenced to flogging, I understand?
Yes, and then Mansour Osanlu, who is the leader of the bus workers union, who has been in prison since the summer of 2007, was just fired. Just a couple of weeks ago, he was officially fired from his job, which means that his family can no longer get any benefits. And this is a man with severe health problems who's been in jail. He still has a lot of supporters. There was a strike.
And once again, he's been in prison on sedition charges or something of that nature?
Yes, mm-hmm. For trying to organize the bus workers union. That's interpreted as sedition.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was the mini strike of the metro workers just a couple of weeks ago, which hardly anyone talked about.
Yes, I missed that.
Yeah, that was very important. And then there are smaller protests taking place here and there, and there are still worker activists who are in jail, like Farzad Kamangar, who's a Kurdish labor activist. He's in jail. So it is not at all true that the working class as a whole defends Ahmadinejad, or even that the majority of the working class, does not defend Ahmadinejad. They're very, very dissatisfied with the system. And they have been participating in the recent protests, maybe not under the banner of the working class. And again, that's another article I published by a young person saying the working class is present in these demonstrations, but not under the banner of the working class. They're there as individuals.
Right, but the banner would be, if we were going to describe the banner, would the banner still be Mousavi and these, you know, elements of the regime who are perhaps a bit more liberal, or perhaps not even that much significantly more liberal, but merely on the outs with Ahmadinejad? Would that continue to be, in a significant sense, the at least de facto leadership?
The banner is called the Green Movement, which is quite diverse. And yes, there are no major working class leaders leading this movement at this point. But that's not because they necessarily support everything that Mousavi defends.
And as you were mentioning before, the December 7th date is more identified with the secular left than it is with Islamists of any kind, even liberal reform from the Islamic reform movement. And so, yeah, there is like an evolution. I mean, some reports suggest that there were fewer green banners at the latest demonstrations. See, because there's two types of ways of looking at radicalization. One would be greater presence of leftist workers as such, you know, under their own banners and so on. The other way would be radicalization in terms of greater militancy, greater degree of rejection of the entire system as opposed to election. When you start having slogans like an Iranian Republic, as I was mentioning before, that's a rejection of the political system.
So, in other words, Iranian Republic as opposed to Islamic Republic.
Right.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. In other words, Democratic Republic is what that's saying, as I understand it. So you have, and the left you know, some of the left, as Frieda was talking about, have been chafing under this for months, because the majority of the left seems to be supporting the Green Movement and not wanting to separate itself off in a sectarian manner from it. But, you know, still, as time goes on, you know, some of these, it's just shifting. In other words, a movement can't, if it's a living movement, it doesn't stay where it isn't the same movement 6 months later. And it's definitely becoming more militant, more rejectionist of the entire regime. It doesn't mean that tomorrow morning there's going to be the collapse of the regime. But I'd say the regime looks a lot weaker today than it did in June.
Mm-hmm. Okay,
one more thing quick.
Yeah, please.
Because we've talked about demonstrations. Well, December 18th is the beginning of the month of Muharram, which is the Shia month. These are the most sacred days in the Shia religious calendar. And the day of a mourning and atonement, December 27th, is going to be, you know, after 2 weeks of this month of Muharram, and that's a day when huge crowds gather on the streets.
And was very instrumental in the 1979 revolution.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so this is going to be something to really watch. And there have been slogans coming from the opposition already to let's turn Muharram into a celebration, you know, of the movement against Ahmadinejad and the election, maybe even more than that. So this is going to be, because you can't tell people not to come out onto the streets on Muharram.
Right.
In Muharram, and especially during the night of Ashura.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this has been subverted for years by the youth, because one of the things the youth do in times when there isn't political protest going on is they exchange phone numbers. Young men and young women look at each other, and you're not allowed to socialize openly, but they exchange phone numbers and stuff. They pass these little pieces of paper to each other right under the noses of the Basij.
Hmm.
Because there's so many of them that the Basij can't really, when these huge crowds come out. So that's going to be very interesting to watch over the next month. And if I were the regime, I would be very worried about what's going to happen over the next month.
I may say something on that, too. You know, all three event dates that Kevin mentioned earlier, the Quds Day, Jerusalem Day, the anniversary of the takeover of the U.S. Embassy, and the National Student Day, are all actually national holidays. These were the days the government would bring out, you know, tons and tons of people. They had parades. They had mass demonstrations. And every one of these have now been claimed by the opposition with tens of thousands of people taking it over and making sure that they, you know, they're claiming it as their own. And so, yes, exactly, these upcoming religious holidays are very major, especially because you also have quite a few of the ayatollahs and religious figures that are coming out against the current regime, and they're challenging the whole theological basis of the current regime. They're saying that the origins of the idea of Islamic rule is that it has to be democratic by the will of the people, and if, you know, people don't want us, we got to get out. You know, so there's quite a, you know, major shift taking place there. But another thing that's very important too is, and Kevin mentioned this in the Logos article that we had several months ago, that the upheaval is a product of deep divisions inside the nation's dominant classes, the reform-minded leaders of the belief that things can no longer continue in the old way if the edifice of their Islamist regime is to survive. And the conservatives believe the only way to survive is to heighten the repression of a new generation that is seen as increasingly at odds with the regime's Islamist ideological practices. This gap that has opened up, we've seen this gap over the last 5 or 6 months develop, and it has really become irreconcilable at this point. New grassroots movement, mothers of prisoners are protesting in the streets, they're standing in front of prisons, there's the human rights movement, the student movement. So this is something that especially the interconnection of the student movement and the women's movement, and now, of course, the beginnings of the labor protests and struggles as well, too. There's something very major going on. really since the last time we talked on the phone, which was back in August, I understand. Really, we've seen an amazing development. The movement has not subsided by any means. It's deepened, it's broadened, and we're going to see some major changes, I think, in Iran.
Well, this still raises the question of what the fundamentally the political content of the movement is. And there's been this persistent line from the Ahmadinejad regime, which has been embraced by certain exponents of the left here in the United States, that the entire movement has sort of been this neocon or CIA design. There's been a lot of paranoia in the regime's official propaganda, that George Soros has taken a big hand. We've got some serious static going on there, guys. Whoever is responsible for it could stop doing whatever it is that you're doing to make it happen. That would be good. There's been a lot of propaganda from the regime about George Soros, the big, you know, humanitarian financier dude. There's been underwriting a lot of the opposition movement, as he did in the Orange Revolution in Ukraine and the Otpor movement in Serbia and so on. Is there any evidence to suggest that Soros or the U.S. State Department or the CIA or any other elements from the U.S. have been have had a serious role in bringing about the protest movement that we've seen in Iran this year?
No, I would say no. In fact, I would say the problem right now is that the Iranian movement is looking like an orphan, in the sense that the world leaders are interested in their own geopolitical interests. As we saw even with Obama, he said, at first he said he would recognize Ahmadinejad, and he did, and he said he was really interested in the negotiations over the nuclear issue, which of course is an important issue, but it's as if human rights can be forgotten in the midst of this whole affair. And then when you look at the left, it's either mute or half-hearted in its support, not recognizing that, okay, maybe as far as political content is concerned, at the moment, this movement is sticking to civil rights, human rights, women's rights, rights of minorities, which is no small matter for the Middle East, for the world for that matter. But this is a movement with tremendous potential, especially because of the interest in liberatory ideas among Iranian youth that I'm seeing right now. This is a movement that definitely needs support. But unfortunately, what we see is, as far as world leaders are concerned, they're sacrificing a human rights issue to the to what to them is the larger issue of a nuclear agreement with Iran. And then as far as the left is concerned, they're more interested in defending Hugo Chavez, who is selling gas to the government of Ahmadinejad and supporting him entirely, and engaged in multi-million-dollar business deals with the government of Iran and calling the protesters CIA-backed. So,
well, it isn't just that the left here in the United States is backing Chavez, who is doing these things, but certain elements of the left here are doing those things themselves. Workers' World, and it's exponents go ahead, please.
Petras.
Yeah, James Petras, yes.
I mean, the only thing I can say, you spend a long time on this, but one thing I could say is I think there's a very formalistic kind of logic that's involved here. It goes something like this: neoliberalism and U.S. domination are the worst problems that the world faces. We need to oppose this. Ahmadinejad is opposing the U.S. and its world domination. Therefore, he's a good guy.
All right, so what is your response to this?
Well, I mean, I think the world is just a little more complicated than that, and I think each society has to be each region of the world, each society has to be looked at on its own terms. You can't just plug in some kind of abstract formalistic notion of, like, there's two sides in the entire world, and on one side is Chavez, Ahmadinejad, and the forces of liberation. And on the other side are the neocons and the U.S. and global capital. I just don't think it works that way. It just doesn't fit. Because as we were talking about before, the Ahmadinejad people are about to enact a totally neoliberal economic policy in Iran. And it's not a secret. They're talking about it openly. They're going to privatize. They're going to lay off a lot of people in the public sector. And, of course, it's going to be a corrupt privatization in the sense that these revolutionary guards and people close to the regime are going to get are going to get to buy up these private industries, as they already have. For example, there's a huge private telephone company, and the Revolutionary Guard has bought that up. So if you're on a cell phone in Iran, the Revolutionary Guard owns it. Not only are they, because they're generally listening anyway, but now they actually own the company.
Well, yeah, you know, the president of that company and his wife, we just found gassed to death in their house. And they're saying there's some kind of a mafia, killing going on there, too.
Hmm.
Yeah. So it's going to be a very corrupt, I mean, it is very corrupt. It's going to continue to be very corrupt. And it's also going to, but it's going to move, it's going to move in a more neoliberal direction. At least that's what is being said. It already has. I mean, look at the way that it cracks down on workers already. I mean, this is what is so awful about the position that people like Chavez take, because the working class of Iran, we could argue about how much support the working class has for the Green Movement, but there's no argument about that independent trade unions in any kind of attempt to for the working class to assert itself in any kind of independent way, such as celebrating May Day. These things are just crushed. People get sent off to prison, beaten, flogged, charged with sedition.
Executed in some cases, I believe, right? Executed in some cases, I believe, right? There was the case of the Kurdish activist in the north who was executed recently.
Yes,
he's part of a leftist Kurdish movement that has Marxist origins and may still consider itself Marxist.
And I believe he was charged with collaboration with this PKK allied Kurdish guerrilla movement in the north. I don't know with what legitimacy the charge was made.
Completely illegitimate.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And there was an outcry among the youth when they executed him.
Right.
All the bloggers were outraged.
And it's very telling that the first execution of a political person for explicitly political reasons since the election protest started was of a Kurd, was of a member of the national minority.
And a leftist at that.
By the regime to use hostility toward minorities in
right.
its favor.
Yes.
And
the left is,
the left.
The better part of the left is always opposed.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, there are several other people who are on death row. What is it, like 10 people are on death row in relation to the protests?
Yes. There are some people who are on death row, and there are also some queer activists on death row at the moment.
Indeed. Since the protest, this has happened?
I think some have been added to the list since the protest.
Hmm. And on the same charges of, charges of what?
Well, charges of sodomy.
Charges of sodomy. So this is a capital offense.
Yes.
Hmm. As in, there's been this huge outcry about Uganda doing the same thing, and this is already the case in Iran.
Yes.
All right. I should point out that it is mere seconds of 1 o'clock in the morning on listener-supported, non-commercial WBAI 99.5 FM, which means we have 30 minutes remaining to us on the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade here in New York City. We are speaking with Frida Afari of the website Iranian Progressives in Translation, Kamran Afari, journalist and author, and Kevin B. Anderson, who is also an author, co-author of Foucault and the Iranian Revolution. as well as other books. What makes all of this complicated, and here, this is really what we should probably concentrate on for the remaining half an hour, because I know my listeners, and I know what a lot of them are thinking. What makes all of this complicated is that we're hearing from the neocons in this country exactly the same criticism that Obama has dropped the whole human rights issue in Iran and has betrayed the Iranian opposition. Apparently, there was an Iran Democracy Fund under Bush where the State Department was attempting, at least.
In Iran, I don't know of any of it being in Iran.
I'm sorry?
On Iran, but in Iran, I don't know of any of them, anything inside Iran from
I'm sorry.
With the Democracy Fund, I don't know of any Iranian dissident who took any of that money or who didn't publicly oppose it.
Okay.
All the people who are today being accused of this kind of thing publicly opposed all those initiatives, just as they publicly opposed the U.S.'s threats to bomb Iran and so forth, which they see as the worst possible, or even sanctions, most of them oppose. What they want is Obama to speak out a little bit more, but most people oppose sanctions as well, because sanctions are not going to, it's just going to, the Revolutionary Guard already makes money hand over fist by smuggling in stuff. And they'll be able to blame any economic problems on the sanctions, which there are plenty.
Yes.
Economic problems.
Well, apparently under Bush, the State Department did have an Iran Democracy Fund, which was...
But they had a fund. I'm just saying none of the groups inside Iran played ball with them.
Yeah, okay. Perhaps not. But in any event, recently I was just reading that Senator Joe Lieberman was protesting that Obama has dismantled the Iran Democracy Fund. So, unfortunately, there has been this, the neocons, even if for their own cynical interests, have sort of adopted the whole human rights question, which has led a lot of people on the left in this country to get confused, shall we say.
But I think some prominent members of the existing opposition movement inside Iran have taken a clear position to separate themselves from the neocons. They did not support the U.S. invasion of Iraq. They do not support the way in which the U.S. is now maybe trying to wink to the Taliban and help some parts of the Taliban in the hope of co-opting them. They support the Palestinian movement while they also support the two-state solution. They recognize Israel's right to exist, but they also recognize the right of a Palestinian state. So these are all issues on which they're different from the neocons. One of the people that I translated in my blog recently was Fatemeh Sadeghi, who is the feminist professor of sociology. She is the daughter of Ayatollah Sadegh Khalkhali. I don't know if your listeners remember him. He was known as the hanging judge after the 1979 revolution. He ordered the execution of a lot of leftists and Kurdish activists. And his daughter is now a professor of sociology. She was fired from her job about a year and a half ago because of the articles that she's published, which are critical of the government. But she's also very critical of U.S. foreign policy and neoconservatives, and she's made that very clear in her statements. And same with Shadi Saj, who's a feminist human rights activist who just won the Tulip Human Rights Award in Holland. Again, she was the one who said her speech was entitled something like "Don't put the human rights defense on par with the nuclear safety concerns." So she's very concerned about Iranian government's nuclear ambitions, but she doesn't think that is, she thinks it's just as important as the human rights defense issue. And she's also critical of Western regimes for not paying attention to the human rights defense issue as much as they should. So I honestly, I really don't know where some of these leftists get their facts. One more thing I might add, Bill. Back when the Bosnia was an issue on the agenda in the early 1990s, I was very involved in support for the Bosnian struggle for a multi-ethnic identity. And I remember back then members of the left attacking me, saying, oh, this is a struggle that defends U.S. imperialism. And back then, I completely disagreed with them, and I thought they completely missed the boat on what Bosnia represented. But now, in this case, now I'm an Iranian myself, and I read this, the Persian press, the opposition press, and I can tell you, they're in no uncertain terms, they do not support U.S. imperialism. So how they come up with that is really beyond me.
Right. Well, but I hear over and over again that, you know, the whole movement was sort of astroturf and created by CIA intrigues. Now, it's very interesting. Very often people will make the analogy to what happened in 1952 and say that, you know, this is just another CIA plot. And, of course, you know, I mean, in 1952, there weren't hundreds of thousands of people taking to the street in defense of the Shah. That's a pretty ridiculous analogy. But there was one caller to this radio show a few weeks back when I was discussing this who raised another analogy, which perhaps warrants greater scrutiny, which was to what happened in what was then British Guyana in just a couple of years later in 1962,
1963. The overthrow of the Chedi Jagan?
Precisely, which was, in fact, affected through a general strike by organized labor, which the CIA was sort of fanning the flames of and pouring a lot of money into. And so it really did have a genuinely populist element to it at the same time that the CIA was kind of pulling the strings in behind the scenes.
Right, right. Okay, what are some of the differences between that and this kind of thing? First of all, this is the South America, and U.S. has a lot more power and influence. Well, that, in that case, it was still a British colony, but you know, Britain and the U.S. Had, I mean, the U.S. still, the Britain still had formal power in Guyana at that time.
Yes.
After what is it, over 25 years now of the Islamic, close to 30 years of the Islamic Republic. What kind of influence does the U.S. have inside Iran? Very little. Maybe there are like foreign broadcasts and so forth, Voice of America, so forth. But that's, you know, there isn't much more than that. And so it becomes the regime itself is. If you look at these trials, these show trials over the summer, and then every once in a while they have another session of it. It's the old Torquemada method from the Inquisition. You basically, you know, you torture people and then you get them to speak the truth. As they, I'm joking. But you torture them and then they confess.
All right,
one
so
guy got up and confessed and he said, well, you know, the plot really goes back several years ago. Part of the plot was when we brought Jürgen Habermas to speak. At Tehran University, and then another big part of the plot was when we brought Richard Rorty. Both of these are people who write for, like, The Nation, okay? So these are not, so the regime's idea of a CIA agent is probably a Western leftist.
Well, yes, the two figures that they seem to have singled out. One is George Soros, of course, who's not particularly a leftist, but is kind of a, you know, a maverick within the ruling class. I mean, he supports drug legalization and so on. And the other is Gene Sharp, the theorist of nonviolent social change and nonviolent resistance, who apparently did take something of a role as a mentor or a guru for the student opposition in Serbia, 10 years ago. He is kind of, you know, a sort of a leftist, but perhaps one who's been, to a certain degree, manipulated or played by the neocons.
Well, I mean, I supported that student movement in, what was it, 99 and 2000?
Correct, correct.
Overthrew the Milosevic regime.
Yes.
And I think a number of people on the more libertarian side of the left supported it. I mean, this, frankly, this debate goes back to the Iranian revolution itself. There were people on the left like Richard Falk who took a very long time to criticize the Islamic Republic. In fact, I don't know if they ever made a strong criticism of it. Then there were others who fairly early on said, well, okay, this is an anti-imperialist regime, but it's executing leftists, executing gay men publicly in the streets. They made no qualms about that. So people like Kate Millett, Simone de Beauvoir, had a different position. Raya Dunayevskaya, with whom I worked, and others, Frida and Kamran also worked years ago. Some of this just goes back to those kinds of arguments, and they revisit themselves. They're revisited in specific cases, and there clearly are cases where the CIA is manipulating a movement, and where movement has the language of trade union rights and democracy, but it's a basically right wing reactionary movement.
All right, now what would be an example of that in your view?
Nicaragua,
mm-hmm. In the 80s,
the Contras. A lot of the opposition to Chavez looks like that to me.
Well, yes,
I don't support Chavez uncritically, but I certainly don't support what has surfaced as the opposition.
Mm-hmm. I don't think that there were elements like Violeta Chamorro and so on in Nicaragua who were talking about human rights, but the Contras themselves, I mean, where they're committing atrocious human rights abuses, I don't think they talked about human rights so much as anti-communism.
Right.
Yeah.
I think there are a number of cases where you have to be a little bit wary. But lots of movements are supported by lots of people.
Right.
And you have to look at the character of the movement itself, and not who its external supporters are. And one more thing, I'm not sure that the neocons and the Israeli government are all that happy about this movement.
Okay, why not? Why wouldn't they?
Because Ahmadinejad is a good excuse for Israel to never negotiate with anybody.
Mm.
They say, well, I mean, Hamas is backed by the Tehran regime, which represents an existential threat to the existence of Israel, and on and on and on. There is that famous, I mean, in the campaign, Mousavi quoted a former head of Mossad who said this. He said, you know, if we couldn't have invented someone better than Ahmadinejad for our purposes. I mean, this is like a tremendous propaganda victory.
Yeah, but I don't think it's entirely cynicism on the part of the Israelis. I think there's genuine hatred of Ahmadinejad.
Oh, well, yeah, but there's also a lot of paranoia in Israel, in the sense,
without a doubt,
that Iran is a long way away from a nuclear weapon, and moreover, there's a huge difference between rhetoric and action. The Islamic Republic has done a lot of awful things, but it's never invaded any of its neighbors. It has a singularly unaggressive, cautious foreign policy. There's just something really stupid about the idea that because Shia Islam in general talks about martyrdom, that therefore an Islamist regime in Iran would blow up Israel and be happy to see itself blown up so everyone could go to heaven. I mean, they're not Al-Qaeda. They're quite different from Al-Qaeda.
Mm. All right, so how do you view, now that we're in the last 15 minutes, this is not the thing which is foremost in our minds, but let's talk about it. How do you view Ahmadinejad's ostensible nuclear ambitions? Is he, in fact, is it all a charade? Is he really trying to get the bomb? And if so, towards what end, in your view?
I was listening to an interview with an Iranian physicist last night. His name is Ali Nayeri. He's based in the U.S. I think he graduated from Harvard University. And he's definitely a member of the Democratic Opposition Movement. And he was saying that while, of course, Iran, the Iranian government thinks of itself as a regional power and does have very strong nuclear ambitions, nevertheless, what they have is not at all comparable to what a country like North Korea has or some of the other nuclear countries in the region.
Well, the immediate response to that question or to that statement would be a one-syllable word, yet. They don't have it yet.
Correct. And even if we're not even arguing on the nuclear weapons issue, even if it's on just on the question of using nuclear energy to produce energy, nuclear technology to produce energy, that's also very questionable because of Iran's the safety record, because they might do it in such a way that would truly harm the citizens of Iran. They're certainly using a lot of Russian technology, and we saw what happened in Chernobyl. So I'm even questioning that, because I'm against nuclear energy for whatever purposes. So I think it's an important issue. I'm not downplaying it. I don't think it's as important as the threat from North Korea and other powers in the region like Pakistan. There are certainly other nuclearly armed powers in the region.
Israel.
But I think that the only way to stop that is to defend the human rights struggle in Iran, to make sure that Ahmadinejad and Khamenei and that faction cannot continue with their policies. But to simply negotiate with them on the nuclear issue, hoping that they would agree to something at the expense of killing the opposition, the human rights movement, would be a true disaster, in my opinion.
Well, we do hear the line that Iran and nuclear and North Korea, for that matter, are under threat by, you know, the biggest power on the globe, the biggest bully on the globe, U.S. imperialism, and that they have the right to pursue any weaponry which they have the ability to achieve.
Only a nationalist would say that, and I'm not a nationalist. No, I think an internationalist couldn't possibly make that argument.
Yeah, I mean, I would just add, I guess emphasize what Frieda and Bill were both saying, which is that, I'm opposed to a nuclearly armed Iran, but I'm opposed to a nuclearly armed U.S. I'm opposed to a nuclearly armed Israel, and I mention those three countries because I think the U.S. leadership has been, its rhetoric has been, and its actions have been just as reckless as anything Ahmadinejad has said or done, and ditto for the Israeli leadership. I found it frightening that someone like Ariel Sharon and now Benjamin Netanyahu have their finger on a nuclear trigger. These are like utterly irresponsible, bombastic, paranoid politicians. I'm very opposed to Iran's getting nuclear weapons, but it has to be seen in the context of a global opposition to all nuclear weapons.
Mm-hmm.
I may say something on that, too. The opposition is also pointing out that it's precisely this kind of reckless, irresponsible, adventurous, language of Ahmadinejad that's weakening Iran in the world and putting it in a position where then it has to take the other extreme of, negotiating some kind of a deal where they would, give up all their raw material whereas if they were more forthcoming, if they were more clear in terms of, exactly what the plans are for nuclear power generation inside Iran, that would actually help strengthen the position of Iran. So they're claiming that that exactly what Ahmadinejad is doing is exactly putting Iran in the pathway of becoming a protectorate of the U.S. because of its reckless behavior, as opposed to their attitude that would be more responsible and therefore would allow Iran to have more of a say in terms of making its own decisions and not having the superpowers make the decisions for it.
All right, so you think that there actually has been some ambiguity on the part of the regime as to whether, in fact, they're seeking nuclear technology to merely for civilian purposes or to pursue a weapon?
Well, in the sense that you have, I mean, recently you had a, for example, the case of a secret nuclear plant that was just discovered
yes.
near the holy city of Qom.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And, in fact, the manager of that plant has recently disappeared. He was in on a Hajj pilgrimage in Saudi Arabia, and I understand that he's the one who's giving a lot of this information to the IAEA, to the International Atomic Agency about Iran's recent.
I'm sorry, are you still there? Hello.
I'm still here.
Yeah, it looks like you got cut off.
Do we lose Kamran? No. Anyway, I mean, we have to recognize that under... Whoa, we did lose Kamran. I wonder if I can try to lose this pity signal. Which line was he on? I don't know which line he was on. This is a bit of a dilemma. Hang on a second. I'm going to guess that he's on 5. Nope. Uh-oh, did I lose another one of you?
I'm still here.
Kevin, did we lose you? We lost Kevin. Kevin, are you there? Nope. Ah, what a disaster. Oh, no.
Hang up?
No, don't hang up. That's strange. I'm still getting the busy signal. Ken, can you help me out here? I think I've lost two of my interviewees and still can't get rid of the busy signal. So I would characterize this as disastrous. Oh, okay, that worked.
You still have you got one guest that's left?
Frida, are you still there? I don't hear her. Oh, you know what? I think maybe, given that we only have less than 10 minutes left, maybe this interview has been unceremoniously ended. And we should just... Or, you know what, why don't I go to some music and we'll try to get them back on just so we can say goodnight and be polite. Why don't we do that? But it's been a pretty darn good interview anyway. Let's hear a little bit more of Niaz while we try to get them back online just to be polite and say goodnight. Okay, turn down your radio, folks. Okay. We go back now?
Yes. Hello.
Yeah, I'm back.
Yes, we're back.
Okay, all three of you. Good. Well, at this point, we only have 5 minutes left, so maybe we should sort of wrap it up in terms of, well, you know, what ultimately can or should progressives here in the United States and the West generally be saying and doing about the situation in Iran?
I think the most important thing is to defend it as a human rights struggle with tremendous potential that is both opposed to Islamic fundamentalism and also opposed to Western imperialism as a movement that involves student youth, women, workers, Kurdish and other minority activists, queer activists, as a movement that is developing and will only develop if it gets international support. But if the progressives, or those on the left, because of course some progressives have been wonderful in their support, if those on the left continue to be mute or half-hearted or support Hugo Chavez and downplay his support for Ahmadinejad, then I think this movement will not get the support that it needs to develop.
Right. Well, I just think that a lot of people are concerned as to whether, in fact, the movement is sufficiently anti-imperialist in its perspective. But
well, I think the left, you know, needs to think more clearly and also just learn a little bit more about Iran, about
yes.
its revolution.
Indeed.
Am I on?
Yeah, you are.
Oh,
yeah.
Sorry.
Thank you.
And I think just at a general level, this is the largest popular movement happening anywhere in the world today. And it's happening in a very crucial region of the world, the Middle East, which is not known for having that many grassroots movements. It's known more for military coups and wars, imperialist wars and so forth. So this is something that the left needs to look at in terms of this is a large, vibrant, popular movement with deep roots in the society of the 21st century. And the left, frankly, the left in the U.S. not only should be supporting this movement, but can learn something from it about popular mobilization. And support doesn't have to be uncritical. Let me just very quickly say, you know, this, we've mentioned Mousavi and Karoubi as the two of the most prominent leaders, and there are a lot of things one can criticize about them. For example, Karoubi was great over the summer in attacking torture and so on, but I saw an interview that he in Le Monde published on December 8th where he says he's congratulating himself. He said, well, as a result of the statements I've been making and so forth, torture in the prisons is way down in Iran.
Well, Amnesty International,
I don't know on what basis yeah. he's saying that.
Amnesty International certainly doesn't view it that way.
No, so there are limitations to this movement and certainly to its leadership, and there's nothing wrong with the left pointing that out, but that's a very different thing from saying, well, it's just all being orchestrated by the CIA or this kind of really simplistic nonsense.
Mm-hmm. Kamran Afari, any final thoughts for us?
I also think that the current, especially Ahmadinejad faction, has put so much political capital into making U.S. enemy number one, and it's very inevitable that if the other opposition is winning, that it may look like, you know, the new ruling people would be closer to the U.S. It will not make the United States such a, you know, enemy number one. But I think in the long run, I think, you know, what you have is actually a much stronger Iran that does not need to make U.S. enemy number one, but not necessarily will, you know, end up towing the line of the US, United States as well, too. So in that sense, I think it'll actually be better for Iranians.
Please remember that this program is supported by the listener members of WBAI New York. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of WBAI or renewing if you've already joined. Basic membership is $25, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive.